topic of tonight is Jewish marriage, but we didn't quite finish discussing the Jewish wedding. We always seem to be a little bit behind in our series, but that's normal. So first I want to discuss traditional Jewish weddings, then a little bit about untraditional Jewish weddings. Just to go through the wedding itself, as I mentioned last week, the best sefer in English language which summarizes the wedding really is the sefer Made in Heaven by Rabbi Arya Kaplan, Zichrono Livracha. It's a very, very good sefer, a good book to read to get an idea of what a Jewish wedding is all about. Start from the beginning. The first thing that happens really is the tanoim, which we discussed last time. The fathers pick up a handkerchief and the mothers break a plate. Then comes the ksuba, which we also spoke about last time at some length. It's signed. Then comes the badekin, which is the covering of the face of the kala, which is an integral part of the wedding ceremony. Nowadays, the chosn covers the face of the kala. There were times in certain places where it was done by others who covered her face. The rabbi would come in and do it, things of this nature. Mazel tov. And this is a very, very important part of the wedding. It is it's really a solemn time, a time to give a bracha. Brachas are given to a kala. It's not a small thing. Not a small thing. That's a very, very important stage in life. In some ways, it's, for some people, one of the more emotional parts of a wedding, when the kala receives brachas, usually from her father, if there are grandfathers, the chosn's father, the proper way for the chosn's father to give the bracha to the kala is by putting his hands above her head, not on her head, because he's not a blood relative. That's the proper way to do it. That's the way it should be done. I'm giving out some more of these copies here. No, I see that we're off here. But it was just given out was a mistake, unfortunately. It's off by 100 pages. So I was wondering why not to do it. Okay, I apologize for that, the technical error. Okay. After the Badekin, there are interesting things about the Badekin, which have become customs which I don't like. I'm just telling you my own opinion. You don't have to listen to me. I'm giving you my opinion. What happens sometimes is that after the Badekin is over, they take the chosn, and some guy bends down, some strong guy, and puts the guy chosn up on his shoulders. This didn't happen when I was getting married, and it's a fairly recent vintage's custom. And then you often will find that the chosn is going like this. It reminds me of Rocky, the prize fighter. I do not like the chosn being hoisted on the shoulders of a friend at that point in time. It's just inappropriate. Later on, during the meal, they pick up the chosn, they pick up even the kala sometimes. That's fine. But at this juncture, not appropriate. Everything is dova beito matov. It's not right. And as I told you, if I'm a Sadeh Kedushin, I do what I consider to be a full job, and I try to be in charge of the whole thing. I said, no. Why not? I said, no. I said, it's just the wrong time. You'll pick it up later on. That's it. Okay. Then we have the procession. Now, the processions at weddings is also a fairly new thing. You know, if in Eretz Yisrael, there's no procession. In Europe, there's no such thing. The whole idea of people sitting down, that didn't exist. You know, in Europe, and Eretz Yisrael to this day, from the bedeck, and they go straight. 5 minutes later, they're ready to stand under the chuppah. At my nephew's wedding, which took place in the a bit over 7 years ago in Eretz Yisrael, so I was in charge of my father Zechor Levrocha. That was probably the last chasna he attended or close to it, and we almost missed the chuppah. Because, you know, after the bedeck, and in America, it used to be the next 20 minutes, a half an hour, until they start anything. Before you turn around, they go into the chuppah. They go straight. Where's everyone sitting? No one's sitting. Everyone's standing. That's how it was in the old days. But in this country, we have a different custom. People sit down, and there's an aisle, and they march down. There's a procession. You know, my advice to the procession is that the shorter, the better. Sometimes there can be 50 people marching down, and then they give out scorecards, so you can actually know exactly how people are marching down. The scorecards are helpful, so people know who's who. All right. But I think better to have fewer people. Sometimes, like by the real, we'll call it the more traditional way, there's only one. The chosn is marched down with his parents and the kala with hers. Or in some places, the chosn with the two fathers and the kala with the two mothers. That's how Hasidim do it. And you ask me, what's the proper minig? Whatever the other side wants, like everything else. So that's the proper minig. They asked Yaakov Kamenetsky once, how come at this wedding he marched down with his wife and this time marched down with the other father? He said, whatever the other side wants. It's simple, there's no custom. The custom is not to fight, to make shalom. And that's the most enlightened custom of all when it comes to these things and most other things as well. Yes?
What's the custom where they walk down with other
candles? Candles, a very important custom. That custom is actually found in the Rishonim, in the Sefer Tashbeit, which is the customs of the Marami Rutenberg, which goes, real Ashkenazi customs, is that the entire chuppah is so appropriate for this week's parsha. This week's parsha is Parshas Yisro, Aseres Hadibros. A chuppah is a recreation of Aseres Hadibros. And therefore, since we read just this morning about the lapidim, about the torches, in effect, so therefore it's appropriate that we go to a wedding, which is a recreation of the revelation at Sinai, that there should be torches, and they walk with torches. As a matter of the entire chuppah is considered reminiscent of Har Sinai, where it says Kof Har Kegigis, Hashem held the mountain over our heads. It's like a chuppah, right? That's this is something which is important and is very, very traditional. As a matter of fact, I'll tell you an interesting story. I had a nephew who got married in Eretz Yisrael. He was not in a Haredi yeshiva. He was in a B'nai Akiva, yeshivat hezder. So when the Rosh yeshivat hezder was a friend of mine yet in Yavne, way back in 66, 67, is the Masada Kiddush. Only two conditions that he insists on. Everything else do what you want. Only two things he insists on. You think, what? One, they have to have torches. And two, that they have to have the fathers marching down the chosn and the mothers the kalas. I was at many weddings as a youngster in the same circles, and then neither of those conditions was fulfilled. I guess the new world, so whatever conditions the rabbi asks for, the rabbi gets. Otherwise, you get a different rabbi. You know, so those conditions presumably fulfilled, and everyone's happy. You have to understand, none of these things is such a big deal. You should let it slide, let it ride, let it fly. Even if it's not what you particularly want, this is not something to. It's almost nothing. It's worth making a fight about. Almost nothing. You have to. You know, almost nothing. And even when it's worth fighting about, you should still probably not fight. I had the weddings that we had. There was one issue that I had really, really felt strongly about. And that was, I didn't want any liquor at the weddings. I've seen too much things going on. I don't want any liquor. I want to have a bottle of wine. Okay, but more than that, I didn't want it. Some of these bars, it's terrible. It's terrible. And so I was successful in all the weddings, except for one. And the Mechutin said, we didn't drink anything. He said, I don't drink anything, but my friends are not going to understand. Da-da-da-da-da-da-da. So now it's left with two principles. One is, no liquor at a wedding. Two is, don't fight with the Mechutin. Well, the second principle won. So you have to know how to just, whoever asked me, I'm such a public opponent of this thing. I said, I had no choice. The choice was not mine. Okay, people understood. Let's go on. So again, the chosn typically puts on a kittel. Chosn goes down first, puts on a kittel. That's a tradition, the white kittel. In some circles, they put a coat on top of the kittel. Not where I came from, but sometimes it's in the middle of the summer, it's in June, and he's wearing a coat on top of the kittel. You're going to faint from the heat. But okay, whatever the chosn is, that's what it is. And the truth is, that custom should be followed. Traditionally, there are nigunim, which are played on instruments when the chosn and kala and others march down. And after the chosn march down, there's a song called Mi Adir. And when it comes after the kala Mi Bad Siach, we traditionally these are sung, and they should be sung with proper nigunim. All the songs, the processional songs, and the Mi Adir, Mi Bad Siach should be appropriate nigunim. Usually we try nigunim of dveikus, of feeling, of emotion. Very often they are songs which are associated with particular words which are very meaningful. That's what should be done. I'm not happy when sometimes they march down to a movie score or something like that. You know, maybe very pretty music, but somehow you think that when at a wedding you should have a some more exalted melodies being played at that particular time. There is an interesting question as to which way the Chassan and the Kala face. You think, well, what's the difference which way they face? You're right, what's the difference? But despite that fact, there are different customs. Most Chassan Kalas today face the crowd. The old German custom was that the Chassan and Kala had their back to the crowd. Anyone's ever seen a German wedding, that's how it goes. Correct? That's how it goes. I'll tell you the following story. It's only a story, and take it for what it's worth. I was once Masada Kiddushin at a wedding, once someone from our shul, and the Rav of the Kala was a very big Talmud Chacham named Rabbi Hillel David, major Talmud Chacham from Flatbush. He said to me, which way are they going to face? I said, well, whatever they want to face, they'll face. Before I had my little paper look, I didn't discuss it with them in advance. Whatever they want to face, do me a favor. What? If they don't have any particular way, have them face the crowd. I said, fine. But why? Because my Rebbe elected him. His name is Rebbe Hutna. And I said, why? I'll tell you why. The idea of the rabbi facing the crowd and that with the chassid called back to the crowd, he thinks come from the Catholic Church. In the Catholic Church, Rav Hutna was a very deep thinker. Catholic Church, it's the priest who marries them. It's a service, it's a mass, and the priest creates the marriage for the bride and groom. We don't believe in that at all. The rabbi is purely a facilitator. The husband marries the wife. So since the husband's marrying the wife, they're the ones who should be facing the crowd. They're the ones who are doing it. The rabbi's only a facilitator. A deep idea. So in that case, okay. So they faced the crowd. They didn't care. But since the German custom is different, and often German customs have been related to other sources where they often got it from in that part of the world. Whatever it is, great rabbis did it. I wouldn't rule it out at all. Well, I give the custom called the preference to choose whatever they please. There is a custom that is in most Ashkenazim have of the Kala going around the Chosn 7 times. That's based on certain Kabbalistic notions, but it's a pretty widespread and accepted custom, although it's in some places they go 3 times, some don't go at all. Fine. The wedding ceremony is really very short, and what's proper, the proper way to do it is to have all the preparations done in advance. And once the bracha is made by the rabbi, who's according to most authorities, many authorities at least, making the blessing on behalf of the chassan and the kala, and they're answering amen to his bracha, as soon as he finishes the bracha, they take a little sip of wine, and then the ring should be placed by the chassan on the hand of the on the finger of the kala. Sometimes the rabbis don't do it that way. They first make the bracha, and then they have a whole discussion. The discussion is really also very brief. Two questions are asked. One, did you buy this ring with? Is the ring yours? Did you buy it with your own money? And hopefully he says yes. And the second question is asked of the witnesses: Is this worth a pruta? And the reason we ask that question is because she's required to get married, even if it's only worth a pruta. Shouldn't be any false pretense. I thought it was worth $1 million. It was a diamond. For that reason, we don't buy. I mentioned last week we don't use diamonds. We just buy a plain ring. With no stones, no semblance of stones for the actual marriage ceremony. It's interesting, the witnesses are called up, that's how we traditionally do it, they call up 2 witnesses, and these witnesses are supposed to see and hear everything that's going on to actually certify and create the wedding. These are not just witnesses in cases of dispute, these are what they call ede kium. Without them the marriage is no marriage. You really need 2 witnesses to see it. There's a whole discussion. What if one of the witnesses turns out to be an invalid witness? Whoa. Are they married or not married? This can happen. You know, they don't realize they put someone up there who's not a kosher witness. It's a matter of a major dispute. Under normal conditions, we hope and pray that they are married, because we want people to be married, right? But in exceptional cases, we hope and pray they're not married. What happens? The marriage breaks up, and he won't give her a get. And now we're going to try to undo the wedding based on the fact that one of the witnesses was disqualified. I'm in the middle of that case right now. When I went to Eretz Yisrael, I gave that question to 3 very preeminent rabbis, and hopefully they'll give an answer, which, whatever, it's a matter of dispute. It's not a new dispute, but it's a tough one. It's a very hard question to answer. So we should try to get kosher witnesses which of course in most situations is what we really need, fine. What I try to do is to involve all the parents in the wedding ceremony, at least as far as the drinking of the wine is concerned. Actually, it was the sipping of the wine. So traditionally, the chassan's father gives the chassan and the kala's mother gives the kala. And the second time around, when they were already married, so then the kala's father gives his new son-in-law and the chassan's mother gives her new daughter-in-law. This is how everybody gets a little piece of the action. When the families are intact, that's the best way to do it. Otherwise, maybe the rabbi should just do it all himself. You have to use these are not hard and fast rules, but it is a way to involve everybody in the ceremony, at least to some extent. The most important thing is the actual recitation of the famous 9 words, which are Hariat Mekudesh Sliba Tavazuka, that's Moshe Yisrael. Behold, you are betrothed to me with this ring according to the laws of Moses and Israel. And these 9 words should be recited before the ring is placed on the finger. That's probably the single most common mistake at weddings. He puts on the ring first and then first finishes with the recitation. It's not supposed to be that way. I'm not saying they're not married, but the proper way is to speak first and put the ring on subsequently. My Rebbe, Rav Soloveitchik, had a custom, which goes back to the old Rabbonim, of reciting the entire text himself as prompting the chosen. It's happened at my wedding. He'd say, Hareyat, Hareyat, Mekudesh Asli, Mekudesh Asli, B'tar Ba'azu, B'tar Ba'azu, Moshe Yisrael, Moshe Yisrael. So in 4 clips, 2, 2, 2, and 3, he prompted me to say the text. There was a conversation at my wedding between a local resident here now, Rabbi Herschel Schachter, should be well, who lives down the block, who was a close friend of my father's, Ronald Levrocham, and he was at the wedding, and he asked Rabbi Soloveitchik, he said, Rebbe, you don't think that the chassan knew the text? You had to prompt him? So the Rav responded to him, Ah, Mishnah Bikurim. So he's wondering, Mishnah Bikurim? We're talking about marriage. It's to do with Bikurim. It has to do with the text which was recited. It's written in the Chumash, Parshas Kisavo, Arami Oved Avi. We say that to say it at night. That was official text to be said when they brought Bikurim. So originally, if you knew it, you knew it. And if you didn't know it, you'd be prompted. What did that cause? Embarrassment. Those who didn't know it were embarrassed. So they started, no matter what, we're going to prompt everybody. So no one will know whether you know it or you don't know it. Doesn't matter. Everyone's being prompted. So that's why the Rav prompted me, even though he thought I probably knew it. And you know, the truth to tell is not everybody knows it. Even if you know it, you get nervous. I was at a wedding when the chassan, who was a major Talmud Chacham, got a little bit flustered, not surprising, and he wasn't prompted. He said, Hare at muteres. For those who know, that's the expression of a get. He was a little flustered. He was too big of a Talmud Chacham. So what I do today is, they have cue cards. Since my chassanim can all read, that they can do, so we give them the cue card. Now everybody's got a cue card. And you read. If you're the rabbi, you should also read it from cue cards. I was at a wedding not long ago. A very major Talmud Chacham was in Masada Kedushin. I was the aide. I was right behind him. He did it without a sitter. And he was way off. In the Birchas Erison, was way, I started prompting him to get the bracha right. People get flustered. You know, there's nothing wrong with reading from a cue card. There's nothing wrong. Yes?
Lahavdil, even the prompter can get nervous and make mistakes. Lahavdil, by President Obama's inauguration, the Chief Justice prompted him on the words, and the Chief Justice made a mistake in the oath of office to President Obama.
Okay, there you have it. So that's just, you're right. Even the prompter can make a mistake. But in the case, put it this way. The rabbi was making a mistake, that was for sure. Whether I got it right on the prompting, I don't know, but I think I got it right. But he was wrong for sure. He was just leaving out 6 words, and it was, so these things happen. Now, the traditional way, in the case of the old time chassanim, who really didn't know much, was to prompt them on every single word. But there was a famous joke my father, Oliver Shalom, would tell about the person with the chassan knew absolutely zero. So they prompt them on every, hare, hare, at, at, Mekudeshes, Mekudeshes. The fourth word is a little bit tricky, because the fourth word means li, which means for me. Now we want to make it clear that the rabbi is not marrying this girl. So he would tell the chassan, say li. So the joke was, he said, say li. My wife and I were present at one wedding once in my life where it really happened. Rabbi Rosenblatt, Shalita, was a Masada Kedushin. The chassan didn't know too much. said, "Say Lee," and he said, "Say Lee." And, wow, it really happened. It really happened. So, you know, okay, how he got out of it, you know, but, okay. So the Rav himself said, "Lee," he didn't say Lee, he said Lee. It was obvious who was marrying the girl, and it wasn't him. So, okay, fine. These are interesting stories. After the ring is given and they're officially betrothed, stage one of marriage, it's a tradition to separate between stage one and stage two. Stage one was the Eris, and it used to be a whole year separating them. Now they're only separated by a few minutes. And to separate it, they read the Ksuba. That's just that was the custom of going back to the time of the Rishonim. And if it's going to be a drasha, speech under the chuppah, that's the best time to give it. The longer the drasha, the longer the separation. That's great. But of course, people are not always interested in long drushes, but it depends on the circumstance. Okay. Then we go under a chuppah. It's important to go under under a chuppah. It should be a proper chuppah, whatever it's made from, cloth or talis, whatever it happens to be made from. Then there were seven brachas that we call the Sheva brachas. Chos and Kala are not supposed to talk because the Bar Pergofen is the first, and they're not supposed to say anything until they drink from the wine, which is after the seventh. There should be no talking. And this is how the wedding ceremony concludes. I just mentioned in the Shia this afternoon before Mincha that in that period of time between the placing of the ring on the finger and the conclusion of the Sheva brachas, she is in a status of what we call arusa. She's betrothed but not fully married. And certain relevant halachic statements, which the Gemara has in Ksubis, are perhaps recited at that brief period of time. The marriage ceremony generally concludes what we call Zecha l'Churban. We remember the most happy time of the sad times, the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. We break a glass. According to the Shulchan Aruch, we put ashes in the place where the chassan wears his tefillin. And this is the conclusion of what we call the chuppah ceremony. There's an additional part of the ceremony called yichud, which Ashkenazim have, which the chassan and kala go into a room in seclusion. And in this secluded room, they stay for a period of time, approximately 8 minutes. And this is how the marriage is considered to be completed according to some authorities. There are issues in case the woman is in the state of Nida. It gets quite complex. As I mentioned in the last year, there are now ways in which this can be avoided with certain medicines. You have to speak to an expert in the field, not just any OBGYN, and you can even speak to me, and I can refer you to an MD who will take care of it in an appropriate fashion. Fine. So this is the if it's a need, you have to put someone else in the room. It gets all complicated. We should try to avoid this if it's at all possible. Then comes the wedding meal. That's important. That's a very important thing. As soon as chasa v'kala, that's a very important part of the simcha. And if I'm serving as a rav mesadik lushan, I stay for the meal. I think unless I have no choice, I put someone else in charge. Because otherwise, things can get hefka. Anything can get hefka. And we put a few hundred people together with no supervision. Anything can happen. Things which bother me, for example, I'll tell you about them. Sometimes what they call toasts, which become roasts. Just switch the R, T with an R. A roast, they roast the chosn, and it's crazy. It's crazy. They're basically dumping on the chosn at his own wedding. I mean, if I wouldn't have witnessed it, I wouldn't believe it. So that's why I say, I don't want any toasts, I don't want any roasts. If you want to give a drasha, give a serious drasha, that's fine. I have to try to arrange that. And I think that the Rav should stay until the Sheva Brachas are done. And of course, the earlier you bench, the better it is. The more people are there. And that's fine. Then as we have a mitzvah tanz. Whoa. That's another wild thing. By Chassidim, there's a thing called the mitzvah tanz. Everyone dances with the kala. And what do you mean dance with the kala? What does that mean? So even big rabbis would dance with the kala, but they would never look at a woman. They still look at a woman. They have their head down, but they give them a gartel. And the kala holds one hand and they hold the other, and they dance with the kala. It happens. You've seen it? In Hasidic circles, it happens. It happened in my wedding. There was enough Hasidim in my family that it was done with a handkerchief, including the chosn with a handkerchief. I remember a wedding, my cousin's wedding, for the chosn, there was no handkerchief. No need for a handkerchief. They're married, Baruch Hashem. As a matter of fact, by Hasidim, they insist that when the couple goes from the under the chuppah to the yichud room, that the chassan takes the kala by the hand and, you know, guides her to the yichud room. They consider that a part of the actual marriage ceremony. So much so that I'm told that in certain Hasidic circles, if she happens to be a nida, which is almost impossible by chassidim, you'll usually get the invitation 3 weeks before the wedding. They won't send it out until then because they want to make sure everything's going to be okay. Yeah. If you just pay attention, you get your next Hasidic wedding invitation. So almost that. But if it happens, I'm told, they still have it. They just hold on to her wedding gown, which is, wow. That's what I'm told in certain circles. Again, I'm not my circles. I can't answer for sure. So mitzvah tans, it should be done in a proper way. A rav should, of course, be responsible for personal questions which come up after the marriage is officially done. I've gotten calls at 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning, 5 in the morning, and I take them, if I hear them, I take them with joy. It's just, but, you know, once. I'm not interested in getting calls like that more than one time from any chassan. Fine, it's appropriate. I should add that there is a custom for those who are able to do so, when you make a wedding, of making another wedding, of helping out a poor chassan kala to be able to make their own simcha, particularly in Eretz Yisrael, where there's so much poverty, and it really is not so expensive. A wedding can be done in Eretz Yisrael for $4,000. In America, that will only cover the... You tell me. I don't know what it'll cover. I don't know. It's, maybe. So it's a very nice custom to help someone else out when you're making your own simcha, which is totally appropriate. I have to talk a little bit about the avant-garde weddings. Not too much about it, but just a little bit. I have in front of me something which is now almost 12 years old. It's something called a Jofa journal, which talks about different kinds of weddings, which are different than the weddings that we were used to. There's an article on page 2 called 13 Ways to Enrich Your Wedding. This is, of course, part of the general, I might call it, feminist or egalitarian approach to weddings. The first one is, a particular Shabbat before her wedding, a certain woman received an aliyah, laying the haftorah at a women's tefillah. I'm not a fan of women's tefillah. I'm not a fan of this either. Turn the tables, have a kalas tish. I'm not a fan of that either. Wrap it up, put a talit on your chatan at the bedeket. In other words, instead of having the chosen cover the kalas face and the kalas who sits there, she'll get him back. She'll wrap him up. Or if you want to do it the other way around, since the kala is not putting anything on the chosen, the chassan puts nothing on the kala. I was at one wedding, which preceded this. They had never thought of this one, that this is no bedek. The kala came to the wedding without her face covered. Have you ever seen that in your life? A kala, an Orthodox wedding, without her face covered with a veil? Who's ever seen it? Okay, so I'm not sure if you went to the same wedding I saw that. But I remember distinctly coming home from that wedding and with someone... driving home with someone, and the woman asked her husband, "Now, did you notice that the kala, his face was not covered?" She said, "Yeah, I noticed that." She says, "Well, why not?" She said, "It's obvious why not." She said, "Why?" I was wondering what's going to answer. It's because his face was not covered. That was a very good answer. And there was, you know, this is the same thing. This is egalitarianism, which has to be exactly the equivalent, which we don't accept. Here's another one. This particular example is given. There was a kala walks around the chosen, right? No. Aside from that, the chosen circled the bedekin share 7 times. Seven here, 7 there. Or as I've seen in other times, they each go around each other 3.5 times. I've seen that. I mean, this is a little. What can I tell you? They add the mother's name in the ksuba, which, as I said already last time, which is not appropriate. It does not render the ksuba to be invalid. They got a woman reading the ksuba, a woman making the announcements, a woman translates the sheva brachas, a woman gives a dvar Torah, the woman responds. Till now, it's just the woman responds to the kiddush. This is unheard of. Literally unheard of. We never heard a woman should respond to a Kiddushin, but I give an example. What does she say? I accept from you the ring of Kiddushin. Again, doesn't render the wedding to be an invalid wedding, but it's certainly avant-garde and really should not be done. And then they say, give a ring to your chatan at the Kiddushin.
But the goyim called it a double ring ceremony.
Rav Moshe called it a potentially invalid ceremony. Because if they're giving, they're exchanging rings, it may be the understanding that the exchanging of the ring which creates the wedding. It's not true. They don't mean it to be that way. I assume they mean that the chosen's ring, it does it, the kala's ring is just whatever. But it's unclear if they think that the exchanging of rings does it. Rav Moshe is not sure that they're really married even. Because they're not getting married in the what really is the marriage, which was his giving her the ring. So it's really should not be done. As I mentioned last time, I'm not a big fan of wedding bands for a man unless it's going to protect him from people who are going to bother him at work or things of this nature. He wants to wear it at work. Then I said he should do it even if he's single, or maybe especially if he's single. But if you want to do it, it shouldn't be done at that point. It'll be done later on. Then there's the next one. Put your foot down. Break the cup. As a matter of fact, I don't like when only a man breaks the cup, which has been done forever, I think since the Chumash Beis HaMikdash. There's even a picture of this thing, because those who can see it carefully. It's a high heel breaking the cup at a wedding. Men don't wear high heels. This is obviously from with a gown. So, listen to me. I've never seen this, but again, you're trying to make everything exactly the same. Have a woman say Sheva Brachot at a meal, and her aunt said the sixth one of the Shevron. In my opinion, you're not allowed to do that. I'm just giving examples of, quickly. They can spend a whole night on this. These new things, I'm not a favorite fan of these new things. Yes?
What about fasting on wedding day?
Oh, I didn't mention it before. Thank you. Fasting on a wedding day is a minig, which is found in the Ramah, and it should be done, unless it's too difficult. If it's too difficult, it should not be done. So those who fast well should fast. Those who don't fast well should not fast. Yes? No, there are many days when you don't fast. Right? Many days you don't fast. Fine. This is, etc. But there are some things over here which are serious, are much more serious in purely halachic terms, which I think should be discussed. Really, it's not so simple. For example, in the same, just give me some highlights of this. So what they do, they said as follows. Ani, she responded to Kala. Ani ishtecha kidat Moshe v'Yisrael v'ata li l'ish. This is printed here. I even know the person is. Prince, that's what she said to her husband. This is not so simple. This is not so simple. Because ata li l'ish means that instead of him taking her as a wife, she's taking him as a husband. And the Gemara says, that's no good. Here they do both. This is really over the line. I know where it's coming from, but better you say it than I should say it. But that's where all these things are really coming from. It's from the whole new push. So I just felt I should tell you, this is already 12 years old. I'm sure that by now, this is already passé, they're up to new things. But I haven't seen the more recent version of it, so we'll just leave it at this. Yes?
That
I think is the next week's. Is that next week's topic? I don't have the exact schedule in front of me. I think that's next week. Oh, it's one of the upcoming weeks. We'll discuss that at great length. Fine. This is all finishing last week's shiur about the Jewish wedding. Today we're supposed to speak about the Jewish marriage. I made copies, but unfortunately, they're 100 pages off. This is at... The person tried very hard to get it right, but I just didn't realize it was off by 100 pages. So I will, I guess what you have is also important, but nothing to do with what we're talking about. Fine. The book which was, I asked to be copied, something called Strive for Truth. Strive for Truth is an English translation of Rav Dessler's writings, Michtav Me'eliyahu. And you have page 28, it's supposed to be 128. So that's what happened. These mistakes can happen. But let me just give you a brief summary of what Rav Dessler writes in the pages that you were supposed to receive. He says as follows. I'm going to read it to you because I think it's so worth reading. This is famous. It's famous from Rav Dessler. It's part of the giving and taking, Kutras Nesino and Netila, which he writes that we often think that we love those who give to us, but it's the other way around. We love those to whom we give. I'm reading to you. I knew a young married couple whose little son was the delight of their lives. War overtook the town where they lived, and they were forced to flee. The mother was away. The father fled with the boy. The mother took a different way. They were separated for years. After the war was over, they were reunited. But you know what happened? The love between the father and the son was deeper and closer than that of the mother for the son. Why? The potential giving of all those years was lost beyond recall. It was the father who trained and reared the child and lavished on him the 1,001 acts of tender care which normally fall to the lot of the mother. The love which springs from all that giving had passed completely to the father. Remarkable. But you love, they say, Ava is in the word have. You love someone to whom you give. That's Rav Dessler's introduction. And since you don't have it in front of you, I'm not going to read the entire thing. But certainly, when you love someone, you should be giving to that person. And I'll just give you the last piece. Why do we find so often that the husband-wife affection does not seem to last? The answer is simple. People are generally takers, not givers. When their biologic instincts gain the upper hand, they become givers and lovers. But before very long, nature relaxes its grip, and they relapse to a state of taking as before. This change takes place imperceptibly. Previously, they were joined together in an atmosphere of love and mutual giving. From now on, they are takers once again, and each begins to demand from the other the fulfillment of his or her obligations. When demands begin, love departs. That is why I always say to a couple at their wedding, filling your hearts at this moment is a wondrous desire to give pleasure and happiness to each other. Take care, my dear ones, that you strive to keep this desire always as fresh and strong as it is at the present time. The moment you find yourselves beginning instead to make demands upon each other, your happiness is at an end. Wow. This is Rav Dessler told every marrying couple. The most important thing in a marriage is giving. If you give, it's going to be wonderful. If you want to take, then there are problems. Problems? Sometimes they can get along, but sometimes it doesn't last. And that's why if a couple agrees to give to one another, we find that even when things are difficult, you know, they continue to give. We find many examples of wonderful people who are giving in circumstances they never imagined. If one spouse or the other becomes sick, I'm talking about, you know, a serious illness at a time when it wasn't anticipated. I'm not discussing when they're 90 years old. Unfortunately, they become ill. So what do? So if you're a taker, you might want to run away. I'm now in a situation where I'm really the giver and the other person's unable physically to reciprocate. But if you married with the understanding of giving for an entire lifetime, and now the spouse needs more attention, you're even a bigger giver. You shower even more love upon your spouse, but you have to be on that level. You have to be on that level. If you're not on that level, unfortunately, we have this concept we see in the outside world, and it's unfortunately even crept in a little bit into our world. I'm sorry to use the phrase, I'm going to use it anyway. A trophy wife. Sorry, I don't know other way to say it. You know, you find these people who marry a woman, and they're very nice, and you know they're very in the 20s, and she has a few children. And then, you know, when 10 years later, when she doesn't look the same as she looked then, so he dumps her and gets another younger woman who's as beautiful as his first wife was 10 years before. And sometimes they even dump that one. There were those who know various, shall we say, tycoons in New York City were famous for this repeating kind of syndrome, which is unfortunately a tragedy. But the truth is that there are both men and women, not one-sided, who are guilty of this. You know, they get married to a man or a woman, and then, you know, a few years later, he doesn't look the same as he looked, and da-da-da-da-da-da, and they just say, okay, enough. I'm gonna trade it in, and try something new. This is not the loyalty that our Torah demands. Our Torah demands the loyalty upon marriage from one spouse to the other, which is not to be given up just because one of these spouses has a certain changes in appearance or in other aspects. Some of the people marry for money, which you should not do. Shulchan Aruch says, don't marry for money. The Vilna Gaon, which is learned as a simple interpretation, is that if a person marries for money, it can have harmful effects. The Ramah is more benevolent. As long as a woman is kosher, he'll be okay. Mm-hmm. But the problem, of course, becomes if a person marries for money, what happens if the money disappears? Money is not forever. Does that mean you're going to walk away from the marriage or from the engagement even if the money disappears? There are too many cases like that. It's called an ava tluya bedavar. Depends upon money. It's a problem. Now, of course, you know there are many jokes told about this, and I'm not here to go over the various jokes. But what's not a joke is that women who come from families who have no money have problems getting married. It's like Tevye de Milchaka, right? No dowry, no money. You know, be glad you got a man or something along those lines. It should be restricted to Broadway or Fiddler on the Roof. Should not be in real life. But of course, there's some truth to it even in real life, and it's unfortunate. And I think that, frankly, we should speak about it and say that this is not the way. This is not the traditional way. This is where the tradition where I came from. As a matter of fact, if you marry a woman from a wealthy home, it can cause an issue. Can you support her to the extent that she is accustomed? And according to strict halacha, you're required to. The Gemara says in Ksubis, Ol imo of any or redis imo, you have to support her to the higher of the two standards, your families or her families. If you can't do it, you can't do it. You have to talk it out. You can't just. It happened in my house once that they had it was an impediment. The fact that the woman's family had money was an impediment to the shidduch going through, because my son said, I can't support her to the level that she's accustomed to. It had to be worked, ironed out. I can't do it. And he wanted to go into a Torah field, and Torah fields don't pay that much money. So, Baruch Hashem, they're happily married, but it was, ironically, it was, and most people, terrific, the best, the greatest, you know. So you have to have a proper attitude towards these things.
But if she's mochel, if she doesn't...
She can be mochel. Believe me, this woman is mochel. I mean, how can you...
In general, if a woman is mochel, then...
Yeah, but if it's not spelled out in advance, in clear terms, and even after it's spelled out, it's not so simple. Because, you know, women are used to certain things. Comforts, etc. Men, too. It could work both ways. But since in most families we have, the man is the one who's supporting... So that's why it cuts in that direction more than the other direction. It's a matter of the man's support. I think we mentioned it last week in the Ksuba, the first one. Did we talk about it last week? Vane Eflach. Did we mention it last week? I'll work.
No.
Yeah. Didn't we read the Ksuba? No. Well, let's read it. That's the first line in the Ksuba, the very first line of substance. The man says Vane Eflach, and I will work. That's a whole new style. When men don't work, a new style. Now, if they're studying. Whatever they're studying, they could be studying medicine, they could be studying law, they could be studying Torah, but after they finish their studies, they're going to go to work. That's okay. There's nothing. That's wonderful. We should be very happy about these things, whether it be Torah field or a medical field or a law field, whatever it may be. Understand? But there has to be an expectation that after these studies are completed, and these studies are to lead up to some kind of a parnasa, which the man will hopefully make to be able to support his wife. He says so. First of all, the Torah says so. He has a supporter. And the rabbi said so. And the ksuba said so. So it's already three sources that there has to be a means of support which to be provided by the husband for his wife. That's what the word means. That's when I read the ksuba for a cousin at the wedding, I say, if I know efforts, you're gonna work. You should understand, no fooling around. You have to go to work. At one point or another, you have to go to work. So, I said I mentioned about the ksuba. I guess let me mention it now. The ksuba, which is, we're not going to study the ksuba in depth here. It's not appropriate in this particular forum to read all the words of the ksuba. We studied it in the shirim sefta ksubas for the men before mincha a while back. We went through the entire text, and I mentioned at the time that there are some people who read the ksuba incorrectly because they're just not experts in grammar. And they said, instead of Rivana Elflach, they read Rivana Afalach. One of the many mistakes that's often made in the reading of the Ksuba. I remember when a young lady from our shul, originally from our shul, was married. Her name was Chani Steiner. Her father, Richard Steiner, was a member of our shul, so the veterans will remember him as a member of our shul, together with his brother, Mark Steiner. So he, when his daughter, oldest daughter got married, came to me and said, you know, I'm tired of all the mistakes in the Ksuba, the mistakes in the grammar, people read it wrong, and the mistakes even in the text. It's not grammatical, the two things don't belong and do belong, what should be added, should be subtracted. So what, you know, great, so do it. Yeah, but who's the rabbi? Who? I have to go to a rabbi. I said, you know, go to Rabbi Shechter. He's a great rabbi, and you'll explain to him the grammar, he'll explain to you the content, and we'll be having improved, new and revised and improved Ksuba. Okay. So they did it, and I was called upon to read the Ksuba at that wedding. I asked Dr. Steiner, please put in all the dots that he wants me to read, which are not the way that he traditionally has it read. A lot of other stories about that, but I'm not going to go there right now. One of them was this, which I've always read Baruch Hashem correctly, and Eflach, but at a simcha I was at here in this community, it came out that a particular scholar was suggesting that in certain Haredi circles where kol is the way of life, and they say Vana Afalach, it's not a mistake. They're doing it on purpose. And he's saying it only tongue-in-cheek. But every joke has some truth to it. Vana Eflach, he said, means I will work. Vana Afalach Hifil means I will make you work. That, you know, we say it as a joke, but jokes have kernels of truth. As a matter of fact, when I speak to a chosn kala, I tell them that money should never be a source of controversy between chosn and kala. Should never be a source. It should always have no problem with money. Why? A simple six-word formula should govern your finances. And those words are, he earns it, she spends it. And if you know those six words, there's never any controversy. That's it. My wife, Baruch Hashem, runs the finances. She allows me to have a credit card. So, which I'm sure there's any maximum one, I don't know. But Baruch Hashem, that's the way I think it should be. And there's never any arguments. It's all, you know, if they're major expenditures, so I get a chance to say an opinion. But Baruch Hashem, that's the way I think that this avoids that part of the controversy. There are other controversies about marriage. One of the controversies is in-laws. Let's be real. That is a controversy. I was asked to speak about this in a community in the five towns a year ago. A community where the people are in their 60s and 70s, the average person in the audience. And they're in that situation where their children are married and they want to know, should they intrude? Should they not intrude? Here's again a simple answer. No. Don't intrude. Don't get involved in the mistakes that your children are making. You made your own mistakes. Now it's their turn to make their mistakes. And control yourself and don't say anything. That should be the guiding principle. If asked, even then you should be careful. Because they may be asking just pro forma. They don't really want to know what you really think. And you have to know. It's a delicate balance. So you say something, you don't say anything. I confess to have made mistakes on both sides in that regard. Saying what I shouldn't have said and not saying what I should have said. I made mistakes. I'm the first to admit that I made mistakes. But I think I at least have the principle right. Say nothing. That's the principle. You say, well, this is an exception this way. But I think and it's important that the chos and kala be told that this is the way it's supposed to be, that once they get married, al kein yazov ish, es oviv es imo v'davak v'ishto. In order to have the couple cleave to one another, it's imperative that they leave the parental home. I don't just mean geographically. They leave the home of the parents to the extent that they're a united couple, and they are one unit, and nobody can get in, not even the parents. And every spouse is required to defend his or her spouse against all comers.
Even if they did something terrible,
say the word terribly wrong, that's a statement which requires elucidation. What do you mean terribly wrong? We hope when you marry a person, they're not going to do anything which is terribly wrong. They may do something which you think is wrong.
But
maybe you're wrong. I don't want to comment on that, because we hope that when a person gets married, the spouse will not do anything which is, quote, terribly wrong. If it comes to it, before you say a word, speak to your rabbi and find out if it's so terribly wrong. Maybe he'll tell you you're terribly wrong. You never know what's terribly wrong. You have to be so careful in how we define that phrase. Most situations, not terribly wrong. You may think it's wrong. If you ask a rabbi, he'll say, it's not so bad, don't say anything, and let it go. If there has to be a correction made, a criticism made, there's nothing wrong with that. It has to be done in a proper way, in a very, very proper way. At a proper time, not at a time of confrontation. There's a confrontation, there's a spat, some kind of a dispute between them. That's the wrong time to start correcting somebody. It's the wrong time. It's just the wrong time. Rabbi Rosenblatt Shalita tells me when he meets with the Chasam Kal, he tells him how to fight. He gives him the rules how to fight. I tell my people they shouldn't fight. So I guess maybe they're. I guess there's a little bit of truth to both. The part of the misunderstandings between Chasam and Kala has to do with the some more fundamental aspects, and I'm just going to refer to them now. Hopefully that next week we'll continue with, on that before we start the next week's topic. One of them is anger. There's a wonderful book which is recommended reading. It's called The River, the Kettle, and the Bird, by Rabbi Feldman Shlita, Rosh Hashiva of Ner Yisrael of Baltimore. Fully one-third of that book, that's a large percentage, is about anger, which has nothing to do with marriage per se. Nothing. That third could have been related to people who are not marrying at all. Anger management. People get angry. When they get angry, they say things they shouldn't say, and once you say it, you can't take it back, and you're as much as you regret it, and it could leave scars which can last a lifetime. Literally a lifetime. And, we all have to, clap al chet, because we get angry. People get angry, and it's bad. It's a mistake to get angry. The greatest people get angry. Even Moshe Rabbeinu, the greatest person ever, Chazal say, we wouldn't say it on our own, but the Pesukim say, the Chazal say, that he on a few rare occasions, he got angry, and it was very costly. He got angry, it was, going to the details, that there was anger is simply bad. You lose a little control when you're angry, and then you say things you shouldn't say, you do things you shouldn't do. It's really something we should try to avoid. That's one thing. That's a full third of the book is about anger. So look it up. Look up the book or other books, so you can even find, maybe even in secular sources, they'll tell you about how to avoid anger. There's various, going to rages, all kinds of rage. They talk about road rage. That's crazy. People kill over nothing. It's literally. This is one of the Yetzer Haras that people have. It's very hard to avoid, to try to keep your cool, not to get angry even when stressful conditions. That's critical in terms of the interaction of a husband and a wife. If they're getting angry, it really jeopardizes and almost even threatens, in some cases, the stability of the marriage. Who wants to be with someone who gets angry? As a matter of fact, the Rambam writes famously that when a couple gets married, the husband, these are his words verbatim, lo ye otsev velo ragzan. That's our princess. I'm not going to submit some of the word rogas instead of ragzan, but that's our text. What does that mean? Don't be angry. It doesn't just mean don't be angry at your wife. I mean, don't be angry at all. Because when you get angry, you lose control. You're a different person. More closer to an Avodah Zarah because you're not in control. And the wife who's trying to rely upon the husband as being the rock of Gibraltar, that's what every husband's supposed to be. He's supposed to be the one who is, the more calm and the more stable and the more balanced. That's what he's supposed to be. And here he is, he's flying off the handle, he gets angry. I have to clap al chet for the many times that I've got angry since I've been married. It's how should I say it? It says, our boy Mishana Okut Bidor, that there was a but I've made many times this mistake. I try to correct it. It's a lifetime challenge. Never stops. Never stops. As long as you're alive, you always have the possibility of getting angry. And it's wrong. We shouldn't get angry. We should try to avoid it. It's a human failing. Everybody has it. And, we should all undertake to try to avoid it going forward. He also said, the Rambam, lo ye otev, shouldn't be sad. Well, what's wrong with being sad? It's the same reason. The wife is counting on her husband to be the optimist, to be the one who's going to always be happy, it's going to be good. And when he turns sad, if you want, I say, if someone's not married, get the sadness and the anger out of your system now. Now it affects you. Once you get married, it affects your wife. You have no right to get angry or even to be sad on her account, on her expense. You can't do that. The Rambam says so. It's a Rambam. Yes. Someone who's clinically ill is not in full control of what he or she can do. That's true. So then obviously, telling the Rambam is not going to help. But we're talking about people who are in control and they're able to be happy or able to be calm, and instead they decide to be either sad or angry, and they're going against the Rambam. We try not to go against the Rambam. The Rambam gives us words for the generations. Very important words the Rambam has. Very, very important words. Rambam tells us, you have to... Mechab the Yosef Migufo, says Ram, quoting the Gemara. That means he has to honor his wife more than he honors himself. What does that mean? The Masho explains, Mechab the means it's in the Ksuba. Right? But no, Okir, I'll honor you. It means, according to the Rasha, among other things, clothing. Which means, in practical terms, if it's X$ in the bank, either he buys a new suit or she buys a new dress, He wears the old suit. And that these are based upon the Gemaras and the Rambams. Very, very important basic halachos. Rambam tells us all these things in Hilchos Ishus. What I did not get to talk about, because my time is up, is what about the woman? What is she supposed to do with the marriage? I mean, so far it's been basically a one-way street. The man should do this, shouldn't do this, should do this. Shouldn't do this. Huh? What about the woman? Does she get away scot-free? No. Rambam has things about her as well. But Belinetta, next week we'll start with that, and then we'll go into the next week's topic. Shavua Tov.